And welcome everyone to another Friday night's Cancel the Cabal on People's Internet Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts, and I'm also recording on my video stream for Paranoia TV and Tesla Wolf Media. Just a local recording so I can put it up on YouTube. I really don't know a whole lot about my first guest tonight, but I will just basically let him tell what his story, a little bit of a biography about him, but I have from Northern Ireland, Martin Wallace. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Good evening, Stephen. How are you?
Hi, very good. Say hello to everybody over there in Dublin, County Cork, Meath, Donegal, and probably many, many other counties over there.
Including good old Tyrone, where I am.
Well, let's start with your story first, Martin. It's a little bit intriguing. Maybe a bit of your background first.
Well, my name is Martin Wallace, and I originate from County Donegal in Ireland, but I have been living in Tyrone for the last 20 years. I am married to a wonderful girl called Eileen, and we have a son called Owen, who is a six-year-old child with severe autism. But that isn't where my story is going to start. My actual story is going to start with what was described in Ireland as the House of Horror for reasons of oil contamination. We had three major incidents in 9 years, and we are slowly but surely piecing our lives back together on the back of the impact that those three incidents brought to our life.
What do you actually mean by oil contamination, Martin?
Well, basically, as yet, in those 9 years, a source of this oil contamination has never been found. And basically, we are no further forward today, as far as that's concerned, than we were 9 years ago. So basically, what we will highlight in our story is just the sheer, I suppose, scale of what we've sort of called a cover-up by the insurance company involved, the mortgage holder, and the big brother, both of them, I suppose, which is the bank that funds them both. So that's basically, I suppose, I'll talk you through that process as we find it from 9 years ago, sorry, till date. And we'll fill in any missing gaps that anybody feels is there to be filled.
Yeah, I guess the first question is, how did you first notice it? Was there a smell, or did you actually see oil? Or
all three incidents, the oil was sort of beyond the naked eye, as we call it. It was just the air particle smell, as you say, Stephen, that sort of alerted us to a problem, but we didn't realize, I suppose, until the actual remediation works began, that just how serious of a situation we were dealing with. You can mistake it for many of things. You can mistake it for somebody living nearby who may be a mechanic. You can mistake it for many of different reasons, but the last thing on your mind is exactly, you know, how it turned out to be, which was lay hidden underneath what we call a water table of your property out of visible sight. And it's the formations of weather patterns that can make the difference to whether you notice it or you don't. During the summer months, it isn't as much rainfall, so I mean it's something that you probably become immune to. But during the winter months, when the rainfall is somewhat heavier, the water tables are at their peak, and oil actually floats; it doesn't sink. So again, the higher the rainfall, the closer contact, the closer the oil the water tables are going to be to you under floor. So that's basically the understanding we have of it. And we didn't realize, as I say, just how dangerous of a situation we were dealing with at first. But that was quickly brought into reality over the weeks and months into the process itself.
Now, Martin, have you ever been told whether this is refined or unrefined oil? Or
It was unused in any way. I mean, it just seems to be someone's oil tank containment, which either leaked in one go or leaked over a period of time. But all we've ever been told in that sense was it was off-site. What I mean by off-site is that we were not the source of the contamination itself. We just happened to get in its way. And its way, meaning that it seeped underneath the ground and then built up over a period of time.
Okay, I see. So I guess what happened the first time it, this incident happened to you and your family? What happened that day?
Well, basically, it got to the stage of living here where you could, we came in from work in the evenings or whatever, and you could taste it in the air. And our first concern, I suppose, that there was only two of us, was to call it what we call the environment agency over here, and just to see what else is, or seek, sorry, a second opinion. And we were evacuated the very same night that we did that, because remediation teams arrived on the scene as well, or environmental experts, and they sort of gave us an idea of what they claimed, you know, safe to unsafe. And the safe was 10, what they call parts per million or under. Anything above that number would have been sort of the higher, the more you go above it in numbers, the more urgency there is to evacuate the property. So if 10, as they described to us that night, was their guidelines, to find out further down the line that the reason we were evacuated so quick was because recordings of 240 ppm, as they're called, were being picked up in the underneath the kitchen floor.
Ah, that's pretty wild. 240 parts per million, and only 10 parts per million is safe, huh?
Yeah, that's the picture we got. It was different sort of scale of reading throughout the bottom floor of the house. Delivery may not have been as bad as, say, a dining room or a hall, but anything on the bottom ground floor level was contaminated. In different ways, I suppose it depends on what way the geographic of the house lies. But the kitchen seemed to be bore the heaviest, certainly the highest of the dangerous readings that we now know further in the line that would have done a threat to someone's well-being, as in their health, and as I said to you, Stephen. Nobody knows that better than myself, I suppose, because further down the line, that's exactly what happened, to the point where I was diagnosed with what's known now as a case of TPH. And as I explained TPH to you, it is total petroleum hydrocarbon, and it attacks the immune system and respiratory system of the body if the intake is sufficient enough to set it off in the first place.
Explain that again, what you just said. You get
it's a bit confusing. I know, it's basically what I've researched and what we've all researched here to sort of put meaning to the incidents that happened and possibly why we feel that from day one the companies involved were automatically out to silence it as quickly as possible. Oil contains a fragment called benzene, and benzene is in air sort of quality wise is known as carbon dust.
Oh, okay, so you've developed a sensitivity to it.
Indeed, no two immune systems are the same as the gallon I take from it. Mine's just happened to be its favourite immune system to attack. And in no time at all, I was into biopsies, and I was into a list of possibilities of what the diagnosis might be. And among those three top favorites, Stephen, were TB, a condition known as sarcoid sarcosis, or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that, anybody, is almost like a red alert button gone off inside yourself, because you just do not know what's one of the three you're going to be unlucky to have. You know, all three are pretty dangerous, but you're just hoping and praying that non-Hodgkin's isn't the one that they find.
Right, right. Yeah. You don't know if there's any history of fracking going on around your home or anything, do you?
Stephen, I would sort of say to you that one of the things I did dig, and I have actually done a lot of research for a book that we're writing together here, and we're actually going to call the book Expressia, which is a term used by the corporates involved. And what actually Expressia means is full and final, non-negotiable, go away, you're annoying us type of an offer, or type of a statement.
Right.
Basically what I did was I researched the area of where my house was actually built upon, as far back as 100 years. And these houses, there was nothing here beforehand of any kind of what building structure or any known disturbance to the ground at all. So we were able to trace back quite a long way. And the first ever build on this field that these houses are in was these houses themselves. So I was able to trace back who built them, roughly when, and so on and so forth. So it's pretty detailed research to, I suppose, inform yourself of what it is you possibly could be dealing with and why you felt that it could be or would be a need to sort of cover up any findings that you might find that would sort of explain the process that we had to go through and why.
Huh, that's pretty wild. It sounds like it's just some kind of a natural occurrence, or somebody put the oil down there, man-made, maybe. Do you know how far down the water table is?
Well, it's approximately a meter and a half, which is a pretty deep pit when you actually see it, as we did. We visited this place to more or less lift meal and so on and so forth while it was sealed off. And to see guys coming out of your home in masks and bodysuits and so on and so forth. You know, I mean, I said to my wife one day, are they CSI? Have they found body parts instead of oil? Because we lived in there and we didn't have face masks. We didn't have bodysuits. But when you retraced your steps to what you saw at the start and no information coming from those involved, you sort of knew at that stage that, you know, you were almost being told, but only when you asked. And when you asked, you were sidetracked. You know, you were taken away from that whole issue of them having to answer the questions that you felt needed answered. So it always seemed to be that the corporates were in control of everything, including your home, and not you anymore, during that whole process. To be out of the home a year the first time around and believe that your hands are in your house is in the hands of the experts. These are all professional people. And then to move back in, believing that this was a one-off and this was just unlucky. And then 2 years down the line, another one strike and the same problem of contamination again, but not as severe the second time around. But I think really the first one done the damage. In between the first and the second, I had fallen ill, and by the time the second one came along, I was only 4 weeks away from, well, major intrusive biopsy into my chest, neck, lungs, liver, and bile and kidneys. So, I mean, it exploded in two ways in 2008. Not only was I facing the unknown, I suppose, as to what was going to happen next health-wise, but then we were also again having to evacuate our home.
Now, you told me a couple of days ago in the chat we had, Martin, that you were out of your house for 3 years at one time?
Yeah, the second one sort of took everybody by surprise. When we started to really ask the burning questions as to where the thought came from the first time and would it be connected to the second one and were the two connected to each other in any way, we started to see evasive sort of attitudes creeping. It was, you know, to have to stand at the site meeting here. I mean, I've been kept on my feet by a wall, leaning against it. I was so ill at that stage, and I can remember my wife asking, please tell me you found the source from the first one. Where was it? Where did it come from? And they quite clearly stood in front of us and said they hadn't found it. And you can imagine what you're thinking at that stage, because no wonder there was a second occasion, because they hadn't taken care of the very first one, which allowed the second one to happen. We stayed out of here, our home, sorry, for the 3.5 years while test after test after test after test was taken, and on 4 occasions between November 2008 and June and July of 2009, this house was declared safe to return to yet again. We held our ground this time simply because there was no addressing the source issue. So our thinking was, well, I mean, if we don't address this now, we could be looking at 3, 4, 5 times and still no answer. But it was during that process that a third happened while we weren't here, which threw the 4 tests that declared it safe into the air anyway. So it was a really good job, I suppose, in that sense that we hadn't taken their word for it the second time round. And that whole process then lasted from November 2008 to way up into the later stages of 2012. And very much since 2012 to now, we've been trying to piece our lives back together as best we can. And given the fact that we had our son diagnosed with autism in January 2011, that sort of idea of routine that children like him or thrive on was always in jeopardy, because you didn't, you know, you could never really say that you'd be here or temporary accommodation until they were actually finished arguing with each other. And you were becoming a very poor second to what we see. And looking through the paperwork, Stephen, it is horrendous that one is writing to the other, and more or less saying, well, if you're asking anything, play dumb. And that's what it tells you. It also demonstrates very, very clearly where shareholders' profits, the money trail, is far more important than 3 lives of 3 people that lay in the balance here, I suppose, or was always sort of up in the air. My attitude towards the whole thing is this. When you're placed in a position of trust, such as these companies involved, surely it's not unreasonable for a family to expect a duty of care. Well, to us, on all 3 occasions, particularly the second and third, there certainly was no duty of care. It was actually more important to shut us down, shut us up, and get us out of the way as conveniently as they could. Which sort of, when you get to Stephen, you sort of look through it and say, you don't want to see this happen to anybody else. You know exactly what it entails and what it involves, and the devastation will bring the 3 lives, and then obviously 3 when no one came along. So we set up a group on Facebook by the name of Justice for My Family, and I wish every single person listening to your program clicks onto it and adds themselves into it and stay with us as we continue the search, I suppose, for the truth. Our aim at the minute is not to chase after them anymore, but to bring them to us. And what will bring them to us is us putting the truth out there of how they treat their customers. That's basically, I suppose, why the group is set up itself.
Yes, togetherness, compiling, you know, large amounts of people, that's always great to do, but still something, just a Facebook page, a lot of times doesn't really mean anything. A lot of times people have to be mounted and gathered into groups talking about these types of things.
We feel that will happen itself on 2 fronts. We believe that the writing of the book itself, for awareness purposes, more than anything else in this world, will be one step that we can take, because we hold the keys here of one particular thing that the corporates haven't got, and that's the truth. The second part of that would be that people will look at it and say, okay, situation, and I haven't a clue exactly what I'm meant to do here. What's my rights? What's my best method of making sure that my home, which is my castle, I suppose, is safeguarded in some way, and we treat it with a wee bit of respect? We'll take you through that right from day one. What to expect, what to do, what not to do, and basically that's the attitude that we took towards it, because I suppose at the start was other people in Ireland have contacted here and said, well, you know, you have been in that position, what happens, A, B, C, and D? And we can fill in those gaps, at least. So if you're 70 years of age, or if you're 17 years of age, and your home is swamped by oil or flood or whatever it may be, there's a guideline there. There's at least some sense of what to do, giving you at least some chance of being sort of treated like a human being rather than a name and a number on a piece of paper. And that's basically the difference.
Martin, do you have any idea how much of your land is actually has the oil underneath the soil there?
Well, from what I gather, the third time this happened, before we were handed back the house, I suppose, we had gas-proof membranes put in. And what these are barriers, which should have been done the first thing, and the lack of a source being found, at least. That would have been one step to safeguard the house. So wherever the source is, if it leaks and heads our direction again, it's going to hit the barrier first and will not get underneath the house again. That's probably most important step number one. Secondly, there are two pumps placed in both the living room and the dining room part. So if anything came through from the semi-detached house next door, these pumps will have alarms. And these alarms go off if they are infiltrated by oil, particularly. So I suppose, as far as that's concerned, we have peace of mind as to a fourth time ever happening. But we also have peace of mind the second time would happen. So you're always hoping that what is in here, what is in this house, I suppose, safeguards you at least. You know, at the end of the day, the house is bricks and mortar. There were human lives. There were a different story the first time around, particularly. So I suppose that's the understanding we have of it. But you cannot just, you know, from our point of view, you just cannot simply say, right, okay, it happened 3 times. Let's forget about it, and let's not be some sort of early warning system or early warning advice for someone else who may encounter the same at some stage in life in the future. I think Aaron Brockovich done the very same for the very same reasons, was just to raise awareness of contamination issues and to expose the cover-ups involved. And we're exactly the same here.
Sorry there. I was typing something to somebody. Have you ever looked into trying to get the oil distracted from, taken out of the, trying to think of the right word here, extracted from the land?
Well, it has been remediated. That's the good thing. I'll give you a fair idea of the extensive works that did happen. And what makes the second one so hard to stomach, or believe improbable nearly, from our point of view when we heard it, and we started to realise, that a second one was actually occurring, £74,000, sterling pounds, which is probably the equivalent of over $100,000. Was spent on the first remediation alone. And for that amount of money to have failed to solve the problem took my wife and myself completely by surprise. I don't know what they spent 74,000 sterling pounds on, Stephen.
You spent that much? Or
no, the insurance company did, because we were insured.
Okay.
Between the remediation costs and temporary accommodation costs, that was part of your policy. And funny, when we started to piece this together, one of the first things we actually noticed was that because there was a non-capped source, the first one deemed our home unmarketable from that point on, never mind the next two. And placed on this home is what's known as a red triangle. And that red triangle means that for 10 years, you cannot officially put your house on the market or on the estate agents or anything else for sale. But when you do, you have to reveal this history. You cannot keep that a secret. So for all the million reasons in the world, this, what was our home, I suppose, and still is to a certain degree, is a noose around our neck.
You didn't build that house, did you, Martin?
No, we didn't. No,
somebody else did.
Yeah, someone else built it, and we bought it once we got married. And that's basically, you know, we weren't here very long as a married couple when that started to materialize itself. So it's...
I would think, Martin, I would think somebody could go to the county, and look for the census who lived there before you. Try to contact them and see if they had problems.
That's what I wanted to touch on as well, Stephen. Because a source issue isn't on the table as having been signed, to go to a past seller or, you know, anyone who'd owned the house before we did, you have to go with proof. You have to go with the missing links that we find here. Source would have been one of them. Soil sample test results taken particularly the first time round, which would have almost had the history of the house contained within them. Age, how long it was down there, what levels, so on and so forth, of contamination we've been dealing with have gone missing. Insurance companies can't find them. The people who've done the work on their behalf can't find them. We think that's the very thing that draws you to the conclusion of a cover-up immediately, is that you cannot get the information as vital as that. We did get two sets of soil samples, and they were what's known as the during and after. The ones that were taken before remediation works would have began are the ones that are missing.
Yeah. Martin, you said this oil is just 1 meter below the surface?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would think that there would be, there would be some people out there that would could possibly donate some services, backhoes and excavators, and they could tear your land up for you and easily put new topsoil on top of that.
Well, that's the strange thing, Stephen. We when the second one struck in particular as well, one of the questions we asked was, even though we were dealing with the second and the devastation that that caused and the situation we were in at the time, even health-wise and all of that, we were told very promptly at that point that because the ground was disturbed the way it was the first time, there was no chance in the second one ever finding the source, simply because of the ground and the way it was disturbed. The only opportunity to have ever found the source of any kind was when the house, the home dug up the first time round. And, I mean, we saw diggers, dumpers, all sorts here at one stage during the first process, or you want to call it. And that's where we feel that some idiot was penny wise and pound foolish, if I can explain it that way, where the cost mattered more than putting it right. And to put it right would have involved two simple things. Either finding the source, or in the lack of finding the source, protecting the home at least by what was put in eventually further down the line, which was these gas-proof membranes and radon barriers and so on and so forth. You know, although they're in, they were three oil spills too late, in the process that would have prevented the second one and third one going under the house at all. We don't deny that, and we've never shunned away from the fact that the first one could have happened to anybody. I mean, it's like a fire, flood, or whatever you want to call it. But the second one and the third one were totally, totally unnecessary and very, very much avoidable. But somebody came in here with a half-hearted attitude the first time, and that was reflected when you had a second and third contamination issues at all. So we know we have pretty much uncovered what was more important to them, the corporates involved, and the people who acted on their behalf. I mean, let me put it this way, Stephen. 2009 for us was probably the worst had some bad ones either side of that. But my illness had its peak. My wife had the shingles, and we had a babe in arms of a year old, and we were living in temporary accommodation. And it was to do this without support during the months, particularly, I suppose, when I think of peak, I'm thinking of between March 2009 and October 2009, how we did it, how we managed to keep it together. I probably never would be able to answer that question, and neither will my wife Eileen either. We just did. We weren't living. We weren't enjoying life whatsoever. We were just existing.
Yeah, you were just existing. What I was going to say, Martin. I know we talked about this a couple of days ago, but have you ever thought of just walking away from your home and looking elsewhere?
Well, we did. We felt that sometimes, particularly in 2009, those months that I told you about, I was hoping that a meteor strike came down and just flattened it, take it away off our hands completely. We never want to see it again, type of thing. But at the same time, term accommodation is not your home. It's not home. It's a house, but it's not home. And we had put so much into, I suppose, making it home, a marital home, that we hated the thought, we disliked the thought of just simply giving up on it. We were happy here. You know what I mean? We had made our own stamp on it, I suppose, from getting married to when we had, unfortunately, to be right, or be evacuated from. But I think, I do believe that your home's your castle, and we had made it as such. But for someone to come in and say, you know, here's the saying I have, Stephen. When insurance companies offer you their services, it's almost like a bet. They're saying something's going to go wrong. You're saying it won't. They're saying, we bet you it does, but you pay for the privilege. We'll cover your back if it does. We'll be there, at least, to help you through as much as we can, to put it right. But that was all lost. That attitude, that whole frame of mind had gone. And the reason I think it went is because when they got in here the first time around, particularly, they saw the scale of what had happened and tried to limit expenditure on it and got it wrong by doing so. £74,000 is no small bill to pay, but I mean, it cost them three times as much by the time the second and third one gone over and all the rest. I mean, there was an offer after the third find, Stephen, of £20,000, and the corporates call it poor customer service. Now, you define poor customer service in that lot. We don't know where it started, this poor customer service, but we certainly know it hadn't ended either. And if I didn't do anything wrong, Stephen, I wouldn't offer you a penny. That's the basic line. And the way they did it was to offer it in such a way of, and I'll refer to it again as ex gratia, full and final, non-negotiable, deal or no deal. Go away and forget about it. Not what's going to happen. As if they've left us with a house that's unmarketable for life, apparently. But more importantly, I suppose, from our point of view here is...
Say, Martin, somebody would like to know is there any kind of chance you're sitting on an oil well?
Funny. We did discuss that, and we tried to keep humor at times when when things weren't so good. We actually said, I mean, if there was an oil sprig or well under our house, it'd be outrageous, like best friends ever. But at the same time, it's always in the mind of anything below 6 foot is the government's and anything above it's ours. Sort of way of explaining it, you know. But if it had been a sprig, we would have no bother, with Gage and people's attention. I'll tell you where I took this to, Stephen, and I mean this sincerely. I actually took the findings that we got and I asked for a meeting. In the Northern Ireland Executive in Belfast with the Deputy First Minister, Martin McGuinness. And we got our meeting 4 days later. And again, the usual story of, we promise, we will, we'll back you, we're with you, and it never happened. Too big of an issue, too complex. So we then followed up by going on BBC, which is one of the major news channels over here on one of their spotlight programs. And I confronted the health minister for the north and the environment minister face to face. And I was promised the moon, the stars and the earth, but didn't get as much as speckled dust from them in return. So it's that old story, Stephen, of you have to say you tried before you say you failed. And that's exactly what we did. We tried everything to bring all the agencies in the north on board, and it was almost as if they were saying to you, well, where'd the oil come from? Every single time. And when you said it was an on-cap source, it was just silence. And I do believe, and I know my wife does as well, that we could be possibly explaining on your show, Stephen, a first of its kind in Ireland to that extent. There may have been oil ruptures before and other properties and homes and all this, but not three. And the health consequences would be very much unusual as well. 303 hospital appointments in 7 years I've had to go through or whatever. Five hospitals, seven consultants, and every single one of them for quite some time were just left scratching their heads because they had no like-for-like case to compare it with and give me a diagnosis. What I got my diagnosis from was from an agency in Wales, HPA, I think it's a health protection agency in Wales, and they took the readings that we did have from the first oil spillage under the home, and what they did was they brought it under what they call chronic exposure, and were able to determine two key factors in it. What they call the 8-hour rule, that is somewhere where you spend 8 hours or more a day, and there's only two real areas that fit that on a regular basis, and that is one, your home, or two, your work. But both would have to be in ground floor level. The other one was confined spaces. And when they got that information together, and under the chronic exposure banner, they were able to write back to us and say, well, look, you know, based on these findings, we reckon, it's our expert opinion, that TBH is the case. And they give me a list of known symptoms from chronic exposure of TBH. And if you place them with my medical record side by side, they are an exact match. Immune system, respiratory system, everything ties in with each other. That's probably what makes it the scariest of all, I suppose, is the fact that, you know, you're into someone's immune system. It's done in a very fragile sort of way. It only takes the slightest thing to set it off in the first place. But you can imagine levels of carbon dust on that scale virtually making its way from head to toe. And that's exactly what the medical journey will show you. It started off at EMT and finished at hematology, or to do with your feet. And that's exactly the path that I find myself going down. It's so similar and so alike that the findings from the health protection agency in particular and my medical record, which was never shown to them, and we sat them both down beside by side, and they're an exact match, which is scary in itself.
Yes, I know. I understand, and I do feel for you, and a lot of the people in the network's chat room feel for you too. They're all trying to give some suggestions, but you know, a lot of those.
It is unusual, Stephen, and that's what makes the drive to raise awareness so important here. We couldn't sit here, whether it was a story coming from where we live here now, whether it's another part of Ireland, or whether it's in America. If I picked up a magazine or a newspaper tomorrow and that type of story was unfolding and I didn't share, or we didn't share, our experiences on it, then how does somebody learn from it? How does somebody know exactly what to watch out for? What steps are the safest steps, if any steps, to take? And how you prepare yourself for the trauma that will cause you, because it is massive. The impact on your lives are just, the minute that happens, Stephen, what people, I'm trying to explain to people is, your lives are on hold right away. Absolutely right away. You're in temporary accommodation if your house is on a uninhabitable. If someone's sick or unwell because of it, again, your life's on hold until you recover, until you get the keys of your home back.
Yeah.
That's the significance that we would try and bring to people's awareness. It's going to be a major upheaval. They say that one of the most stressful things you'll do in your life is move home. Well, we've had plenty of those, I suppose, here. And we just don't kind of sit back and not at least place something on the record and at least something for somebody to fall back on as far as advice is concerned and awareness. I mean, that's the key to what could be a nasty piece of work on you and being able to make it through it. You know, I'm just glad Steve and me were strong as we were. My marriage is strong. It needed to be.
Are you there, Martin?
Yeah.
Okay. Explain to us what you told me the other day about your son and the, I think it was the second incident of the oil coming up.
Yeah, what really, I suppose, grabs the imagination is the best way to describe it, Stephen, is that my first input into any hospital for any reason is actually dated the 7th of March, 2007. And I had my first of 7 biopsies on the 12th of March, 2007, which was into my lungs and my left hand side. And that was the very first finds, I believe, of ever them finding carbon dust. That was the first unexplained mystery of how did that get there, type of thing. My son Owen, who to us, and I know a lot of couples listen to your shows, they will relate to this, is a gift, always has been. I think he was sent to us at the very right time, if there was ever such a thing. Because without him, you know, he kept you focused, he gave you a reason to get up in the morning, no matter how you felt. But he was born on the 10th of the 1st, 2008. And a lot of questions have been asked at that time, but I think the biggest one started to be asked when the biopsies into my neck and chest areas were carried out, and they again came back with carbon dust. And this was just an off-the-cuff remark that was made to me one day, and then we started to come back from January 2008, 9 months, which would have taken you to April 2007. And with the recordings already in there, and the medical investigation already ongoing, you just can't help but wonder what was going to be my body at the time capable of affecting a terribly going, because it's strange. It's just, you just don't know, because so much has been hidden from you, from me both. So it does quite raise massive concerns and too many unanswered questions as far as I'm concerned. But my deep suspicions would be that my body's already carrying the carbon dust. There's no doubt about that. And it was showing up on tissue samples, biopsies, and so on and so forth. There's nothing in this world that would, you know, convince me that it was possibly, very likely, in the reproductive organs of my body as well.
Yeah.
That's scary. That to me struck me like a bolt of lightning, because you know the journey you took from March 2007 and just how ill it became even, you know, then afterwards. So it's with so much else hidden, why wouldn't they hide that even as a possibility?
Yeah. And your son, your son has severe autism, right?
He has indeed. And that, to me, is just, when I read into the formations of autism, I know there are, these are only suspicions, even by the experts of autism, that there is an environmental question hanging over it. And given the fact that we were dealing with environmental issues here already, are the two in any way linked? I'm not smart enough to say that they are, Stephen, but I'm not stupid enough to ignore them either. What do I really think? Anything's possible. Certainly. Anything's possible when the tooth has been hit.
Certainly is.
If there was no connection to one whatsoever, they would have thrown it up at us and said, well, there's absolutely no way in this world that was possible.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? And that will always draw your suspicions. He's a little guy, and very few people in this world inspire me, but he does. He's a very brave little fella. He has autism in two main traits, his eating and his speech. And regardless of what he can or can't do, or what he can eat and what he cannot eat, he's the most lovable wee fella. And I'll say it, a daddy's boy.
Yeah.
Through and through. And for the last 1.5 years, four years in particular, I have been his main care, as I recovered anyway. And there's a bond there that is so remarkable, given, I suppose, the disruption that we had. But that bond's still there. And it's the same with mum as well.
Yeah.
So again, we have the task of bringing him through the process of dealing with the autism and teaching them at the same time the rules of life, as we call it. And we do it alone, just the two of us. The mum and myself and families have proven that when you're scared of something, you stay away from it. And they certainly have that attitude towards Owen. But our honest opinion here is that it's their loss, not his. He'll still thrive no matter whether in or out. He can do without the culture of ignorance. I actually feel that that's the case. Lack of understanding is a wee bit different. Lack of understanding to me on the subject of autism is when you try and you just quite can't get the grips with what you're trying to achieve. Ignorance to me is when you don't even try at all.
Yeah. Martin, tell me, what are you disabled with? You didn't mention it the other day.
Well, my main areas, I suppose, there's a unique insight into the connection with Owen as well, but I would sort of say that further down the line. Where I'm having still issues is lung functions and glands that still swell to the point of they become infected, and they have to be drained in a certain way with needles and so on and so forth. So that's still very much an ongoing type of process. But compared to where I was in 2009, I am a million times better, but still not perfect. Will I ever be perfect again? Probably not. Just too much has gone on in there, inside the body itself, that could not have, you know, escaped that type of a hit without some sort of long-term lifetime damage to something. What springs to my mind in that is my left lung. My lung functions are improving again, but they're not on the 86% that they were at the beginning of the process of tests and so on and so forth. But, I mean, who knows? Who knows? You never stop trying.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can give your Facebook site, or do you have a website also now, or you can have people contact you? Or?
Well, at the moment, I'm in the learning process of all this stuff. I do have two things here that I can say to you definitely over the line. One is the actual Facebook page itself. Now, how it operates is you add yourself in, you can read whatever you wish. Any sort of information you feel you require. There are four admins of the page itself, and any one of the four of us can help or assist in any way to give you the information you seek. And that is under, again, as I say, Stephen, Justice for My Family on Facebook. And it'll come up with some almost 6,000 people involved. Again, spreading out the message of awareness. The other would be, if it's okay, Stephen, it's not unusual to give out your email address online, which would also enable someone to correspond with me if there's any...
Certainly.
They want information on.
Certainly.
And that is Wallace394 at talktalk.net.
Go ahead and spell that out for us.
All right. It's Wallace, W-A-L-L-A-C-E, 394 at talk, T-A-L-K, T-A-L-K again, .net.
Well, Martin, I guess if people that are listening, they can also contact anyone in the People's Internet Radio, and they can get in contact with me.
Mm-hmm.
My email address is roberts70652@comcast.net. That's R-O-B-E-R-T-S, 70652@comcast.net. And I can get anyone in touch with Martin.
Well, Stephen, I'd be on the Justice for My Family update and as much as I can, you know, I would say maybe once, twice a day. And the reason I go on so often for that is to take the shoe sellers away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the sunglasses and so on and so forth. But here in my possession is a wealth of not only written documentation, but also massive amounts of photo.
Photo evidence, yes.
Yeah. Photo proof of trial pits and the state of the houses was when the digs were going on, you know. And they are real eye-openers because they will show you, despite the attempts to class the house is safe on four occasions, a live test being carried out on camera.
Yes.
And the oil bubbling to the surface of the water table. It was horrendous.
I can imagine.
You can't explain that to anybody until they actually see a photograph of it. And you'll see in one of the photographs in particular, the live probe, as they call it, which is a big yellow table implement that goes down into the ground and causes ripples. And if there's anything down there, they then come to the surface. And it's a live test. And the next photograph to it is of real oil. You know, and it was incredible to watch. And my mind's getting, it was a Wednesday, and I got the phone call to say, you better get up here quick because it's not safe. Despite
yeah.
their attempts.
Yeah.
You know, to assure you otherwise. So, my reasons for being on your show, Stephen, was to share the story, to reassure anybody that is in a similar or any even a like part of that process, that advice is here. And if it saves you from being driven completely demented, then it's got to be worth a try from two people who know exactly the process that you will face and where and what steps you should take that are best for you, not the people you bring in to solve it for you or to help you solve it, because no one man on his own can do so. But definitely, definitely, definitely to limit the impact it'll have in your life at least, you know, and I would feel selfish if I have all this knowledge. And what I've discussed with you, Stephen, throughout this interview is really deep knowledge of the processes and the sort of areas that it covers. That's the big game, is to raise the awareness as to what these companies can do if it suits them, you know. You can have all your I's dotted and your T's crossed and think that you mind your P's and Q's perfectly. But by having insurance in place in the event of something going wrong, that's the bottom line.
Yes,
these guys decide otherwise.
Yes, you can, Martin. And maybe I'll maybe someone else in the group can have you on sometime, or I can bring you back on again sometime, and we can talk some more. But I have to jump now, though.
No bother at all. No problem. Thank you very, very much, Stephen, for having us.
Well, you're welcome.
And a chance to share with your viewers, I suppose, what is effectively a rare occurrence.
Yes, yes it is.
And one that shouldn't be underestimated by any means as far as, you know, ever happening again as opposed to anyone else.
But exactly.
There's always hope out there.
Exactly.
There's always somebody who will be able to help. And we're two of those people.
Exactly. Well, we have a very, very extensive group, and I also mentioned to you in the chat we had the other day that there are quite a few people all around the world that have successfully treated and cured autism. So
that's awesome. Absolutely. I would definitely be something that would be worth following up, because it's, you know, this little lad has a life of stigma ahead, and you know how cruel it can be when you're stigmatized because you're different, you know. And I, growing up as a kid myself, would have had forms of autism.
Yeah.
But nothing similar to Owen, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I do understand them. I do understand the trapped in a bubble.
Oh, yes.
Trapped in a bubble feeling. You know, yes. People walking past you, and you're trying to make them understand, but you can't. You know, you just don't know how to express that. And that's where Owen is. You know,
yes.
He's trying so hard to communicate with people, and because they don't understand him, then they think he's there to be ignored.
Which exactly. Is always the case. Exactly. So I'll let you go here now, Martin. It's a little after midnight there.
Okay. Thank you very much for having us on, Steve.
Yes.
And thank you very much. As I say, thanks, my dear, for giving us a chance to at least explain the situation and the story as we see it here.
All right. Take care.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. All right, everyone. I'm going to put on a quick break here and bring up my next guest.